Okay, I think we're set then. So we'll go ahead and look to the Lord and get started. Father, we're grateful for the morning and for the opportunity to gather together again. We're thankful for your word and for the opportunity we have to study it together. And as we look into it today, we're grateful for even this doctrine that is doctrine that we believe but don't practice. But yet it is your word, and as we look into it, we're grateful for it and just ask for your blessing on the day and on the time, and that might the Spirit guide our thoughts as we move along, and we'd be grateful for that. Amen. Amen. Okay, we are picking up in Jeremiah chapter 39, chapter 36. I'm going to go back there by way of introduction, though. And right at the end of chapter 36, we see that they were running out of food in the city. But we also see that Jeremiah is in the court of the guards of the prison. He's in the court of the guards, though. And that's where he is remaining at that time. Chapter 38 went on to describe how some of the leaders, some of the officials came to the king and got permission to do away with Jeremiah because of his message. His message was something that they didn't want to hear, how God was going to allow the city to be destroyed and the people taken away and removed from the land. And so they got permission, so they threw him down into the cistern or the pit, this pit in the court of the guards, and it was it had no water in it, but it was muddy. And so they dropped him down, and he sunk in the mud, and they put him there to die, except that one man, Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, who was a eunuch in the king's house, he heard what they had done or saw what they had done to Jeremiah, and he goes to the king. The king is out watching, sitting in one of the gates, and he's watching and probably just observing what's going on around about, because the word is that the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, are coming back to take the city. And so Ebed-Melech talks to the king and gets permission to go, and the king tells him to rescue Jeremiah, to take some men and to pull him out of the well, which are the pit, the cistern, which he does. And so he delivers him. And it, again, we could say that God had more for Jeremiah to do. He wasn't through with him yet, so he's spared and pulled out of the cistern where he's sinking in the mud, a miserable condition to be in, and having no food. And so they figured he would starve to death in the cistern, and that was their whole intent, was to get rid of him. But then as we came to the end of chapter 28, we see that having been rescued out of the cistern, he's left in the court of the guard. He's still imprisoned and left there. But then the king asks for a meeting, and so he has a secret meeting with Jeremiah in one of the gates of the temple. And as he does so, he wants Jeremiah not to hide anything from him, give him the whole story as to what's going to happen. Now, Jeremiah does just that. Now, the word from Jehovah to the king and to the people of Judah, the people that are involved there, there was a word to them, and the word was specifically to Zedekiah. What was Zedekiah to do? Well, if Zedekiah, if he would leave the city voluntarily and go and submit himself to the king of Babylon and go peacefully into captivity, the city would be spared. And so we noted this is one of those places where you do have a potential and an actual. God said that if the king did what, if he left and did it voluntarily, the city would be spared. But the other option was that he stay and he rebel and he stay in the city. And as a result of his being in the city and rebelling against the king and resisting the king of Babylon, He was going to go to Babylon anyway. It was just going to be the hard way. And the city of Jerusalem would be destroyed. People would die by the sword. They would die by famine. They would die by pestilence. You had all of those things that were said, that Jehovah had said over in chapter 38 and verses 2 and 3. And these men, they told the king, this is what Jeremiah has said, that this was the word of Jehovah, that this is what will take place. And that was what Jeremiah was saying. So that's why they tried to get rid of him. They thought if they got rid of him, maybe they would be able to resist the king Nebuchadnezzar and his armies better if they did, if they got rid of Jeremiah. So anyway, Zedekiah, he preserves the life of Jeremiah, and that's what we saw at the end of chapter 38. And as we come to the last verse, though, it says, "So Jeremiah abode in the court of the prison until the day that Jerusalem was taken." And he was there when Jerusalem was taken. So he's in this court of the guards. He's there under guard. He's a prisoner. And it was till the day that Jerusalem was taken. Now, the next chapter then picks up, and this is where we're going to pick up today. And as we said, Zedekiah, as God said, Zedekiah had two options. The first option was go peacefully, go deliberately, and go submit yourself, turn yourself over to the king of Babylon, save the city. The second option is stay here, resist, rebel, and you'll go to Babylon, but the city will be destroyed. And so you had the options. And so this is the option that God gave to the king Zedekiah, and it affected the nation. And so it affected the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem could have remained, but it was the weight of all of this was on the shoulders of Zedekiah. And remember, Zedekiah, he said, well, he was told Jeremiah, he was kind of fearful of what those who had gone to Babylon before him from Jerusalem and from Judah, what they might say to him, and they might mock him, or they might treat him cruelly. And so he resists on that score. But today we're going to see that it cost him not to do what God, the option that God gave him to do. And so the potential was sparing the city. The actual is the city is going to be destroyed. And that's what we'll see as we move into the account today. And so we do find the fulfillment of the prophecies that we've seen down through the book of Jeremiah, dealing with the future destruction of the city, the fall of Jerusalem, and its ultimate destruction, where it will be utterly destroyed. And it's going to take place during the reign here of Zedekiah, and it's going to be in his 11th year that will take place. Now, as we begin, and I'm going to be moving back and forth between Jeremiah 39 and 2 Kings chapter 25. But as we begin in Jeremiah 39:1, and when we move back to Kings, you might want to put a marker in both places, because we'll be bouncing back and forth. You have the same information in 2 Kings 25, the historical account of it. In Jeremiah, you do have the prophetic words that this was going to take place, and it did take place just as Jeremiah prophesied. You have a little different, you have a little addition in some of the places, in one or the other passage, though, dealing with the events historically. So as we begin, you see the city surrounded by the armies of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, we've seen reference to this earlier, but it says, "In the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the 10th month, came Nebuchadnezzar," and this is just a different spelling here in the AV, Nebuchadnezzar, but it's "King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army against Jerusalem, and they besieged it." And so they have surrounded the city. And why did this happen? Because of Zedekiah's failure to do what God had suggested that he should do. He told him, go down to Babylon, turn yourself over to the king Nebuchadnezzar. And he didn't do it. And the reason that the king of Babylon is coming in the first place is because of the idolatry of the nation. They were spiritual adulterers. And we've seen that throughout the study of Jeremiah so far. They had idols. They worshiped the idols of the lands, the peoples around them. And so they polluted the land. And so they polluted it in such a way that God is going to make sure that the land gets its rest from them. And so they're going to be removed. All but just a handful will be gone, taken into captivity. And so there's the layout here, though. There's a resultant siege here that takes place. And you do have some specific dating. And this is going to be in around June or July. Looked at the wrong reference there, but the next reference. But this is January, February of the year 588 B.C., and so the 10th month by their religious calendar would be Tebeth, and it would be around our January, February. And now back in 2 Kings 25 and verse 1, we'll notice the same information given. It is referenced three times, this date that this takes place. And we'll just look at these two. And it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the 10th month, in the 10th day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his host, his armies, against Jerusalem and pitched against it, and they built forts against it round about. And so you see how they besieged the city, and the city was besieged unto the 11th year of King Zedekiah. And so it goes down to the 11th year of King Zedekiah, and when it's speaking of Zedekiah, we saw him back in chapter 24 of 2 Kings before, and his name was Mattaniah. He was Jehoiakim's brother, and he was the uncle of Jehoiakim, who was taken, or Jeconiah, who was taken into captivity after 3 months of ruling. And he appointed this Mattaniah and changed his name to Zedekiah. But anyway, we see that they're besieged for this period of time. Back in Jeremiah, in verse 2, it says, "And in the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the 4th month, the 9th day of the month, the city was broken up." And so there you have the account in Jeremiah. Now, by calculation, it depends on how you calculate it from all I've figured, have been able to see in it, but this could be a 1.5 to 2.5 year siege upon the city. But you notice back in 2 Kings that they pitched against it, they built forts against it, they encircled the city. And so they had the city surrounded, so they were without food, and the food was running short, and they were running. By the time you get to the end of the siege, they're out of food. But then at the end of verse 2 in Jeremiah 39, it said that the city was broken up. Now we can go back to 2 Kings again. And you see a reference, first of all, before the city was broken up in verse 3, you come to the famine. And on the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine prevailed in the city, and there was no bread for the people of the land. And so they did run out at this time. And the next event in 2 Kings 25 is the breaking up of the city, verse 4. "And the city was broken up, and all the men of war fled." Now, we're going to leave it there, and we'll go back over to Jeremiah. We'll come back to this in 2 Kings, but we want to come back over to Jeremiah, first of all, and we see the officials of the kingdom of Babylon, the princes, it says, these who were the noblemen, those who were key men, came and they entered into the city, and there they sit in the city, and one of the gates in the middle gate of the city, it says. Now, exactly which gate that was, again, there's some, I'm not real sure which one, but anyway, they came. All the princes of the king, verse 3, of Babylon came in and sat in the middle gate. And now you have some names here of some of these, and again, it's questionable whether some of these are titles going with previous names or not. Some of them very well may be, but you do have two Nergal-Sharezers, one from Samgar-Nebo, and then you have Sar-Shechem, Rab-Saris, then you have Nergal-Sharezer-Ramag, with all the residue, all the remainder of the princes of the king of Babylon. So there is a group of these men who come in, sit in the middle gate as they've broken down the wall. And the reason they would do this was they were taking control of the city, and probably they're also executing some judgment upon those who had resisted within the city. And so there you have these men who enter in. Now, it is kind of interesting. We find one of these kings, one of these men became king ultimately. And I believe it's the first one, which is Nergal-Sharezer, Samgar-Nebo, is probably the one who was, but you have two with that name. But he was the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. And when Nebuchadnezzar's son, evil Merodach, died, then this fellow stepped in as king, and he was king from about 860 to 856 for about 4 years. And so one of these men ultimately became king of Babylon, but there are the leaders who come and sit within the gate, though, and indicating they had conquered the city. So it's they're in charge and control of it, of the city of Babylon. And so that's the next event that we see here, is that they come through. Now, and so they're in the city. Then we come to verse 4. And as we approach verse 4, verses 4 through 7, we see the flight of Zedekiah and his army. Now, if you remember, before we look at this, Zedekiah kind of has a ragtag army. These are not his best troops, the best troops of Judah. Earlier on, we had Nebuchadnezzar come and take Jeconiah and his whole family, his mother, his wife, his sons. He took all of the men who were craftsmen, those who were the most talented, the most important men of Judah, were already taken away into captivity at that earlier date. And we noticed that earlier in the book of Jeremiah, where he took these, where they were taken away earlier. So what was left was just sort of these were not the elite troops of Judah, but these were just kind of a ragtag army, we could say, who were put together defending the walls of the city. And so they were able to hold out for quite some time before they were overtaken and the wall was broken and the city was broken up. Now, Jeremiah, again, is not writing absolutely in chronological order as he goes through. And now you have these men, they've entered in and they've sat down in the middle gate. But now, in verse 4, and it came to pass that when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, saw them, he saw these who Babylonians who had entered in and all the men of war, then they fled. So he saw Nebuchadnezzar's armies. He saw they had broken in. And so now he flees, and they went forth out of the city by night. And so they try to get away by stealth at night, sneaking out. And as they do so, it was by way of the king's garden by the gate between the two walls. And he went out the way of the plain. Now that's the brief account here in Jeremiah chapter 39. And now we'll go back to 2 Kings. And so we're We're working between 2 Kings 25 and Jeremiah 39, looking at the fall of Jerusalem. And so this is going to take place. The fall actually took place in 586 B.C., and it would have been around June or July, if we go by their religious calendar, and it was when they ran out of food. But they broke down the wall and came in. So that's in Jeremiah 39 and in 2 Kings 25. But going back to 2 Kings 25, we'll pick up in verse 4 where we left off. And the city was broken up, and all the men of war fled by night and by the way of the one gate between two walls, which is by the king's garden. And so now you see where they fled. Now the Chaldees were against the city round about, and the king went the way toward the plain. And so they snuck out by night, and they headed out. Now the calculation is that when the Babylonians came and took the city, they broke the wall. They broke it in the northern part of the city. So the king, Zedekiah, and his army of ragtag soldiers, they fled out of the southern part of the city. And when they did so, they had to come down to where you have the Valley of Hinnom, and you have the valleys coming together there. So they had to go down through into a ravine to escape, and that probably aided them to do so. But they went through the Kidron and the Valley of Hinnom where they come together, and then they had to go up over the Mount of Olives, and then they headed out to the plain. The Jordan Plain, and they're going to end up getting captured before they get terribly far away. They don't escape, though. And so this is what happens when Jerusalem falls immediately. Zedekiah flees, though, and the verse 5 back, we're working between 2 Kings 25 and Jeremiah 39. We have two parallel texts. One giving both of them giving you a historical account. Jeremiah filling in the fulfillment of the prophecy as it was given by Jeremiah, and it's going to come back to Jeremiah again, which 2 Kings 25 doesn't do. But we're back in Jeremiah 39, and we're looking at verse 5. But the Chaldeans' army pursued after them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. So they got out about to the plains of Jericho. And when they had taken him, they brought him up to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, to Riblah in the land of Hamath. And so they didn't go all the way to Babylon, but they where he gave judgment, literally spake with him with judgments. And so Nebuchadnezzar speaks judgment against King Zedekiah. And then back over to 2 Kings, chapter 25, we find in verse 5 the same event. And the army of the Chaldeans pursued after the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho. We have the addition here that Zedekiah's armies were scattered from him. And so the king has left, his armies flee with King Nebuchadnezzar coming upon him. Now, you have the account in verse 6. So they took the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon, to Riblah, and they gave judgment, or they spake judgment with him. And so now they're going to judge. Judgment is coming upon Zedekiah. Now remember, if Zedekiah had gone voluntarily again, we'll emphasize that again, that was the word that Jehovah had spoken. If he went peacefully and went to, became subordinate under the king Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, none of this would have happened. But it did. And so again, the actual event that took place was the destruction of the city and judgment upon Zedekiah. And it's going to affect Zedekiah in a pretty sad way. And the judgment is seen as we move back to Jeremiah chapter 39, and we will pick up in verse 6. And the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah in Riblah before his eyes. And so that's kind of interesting before his eyes, but he slew all of his sons. Also, the king of Babylon slew all the nobles of Judah. And so he slays all of these important people besides the sons. And then he's going to, we'll keep going in Jeremiah 39. And moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes. And so he made him blind. And so he made him blind. He probably poked his eyes out some way and bound him with chains, it says, or with two brazen chains or with fetters to carry him to Babylon. Now, back in 2 Kings 25, it describes this a little how he's carried off in verse 7. And they slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes and made him blind. Made the eyes of Zedekiah blind and bound him with fetters of brass and carried him to Babylon. So he's bound and chained, he's hauled off to Babylon, and he's blind. Now the last thing that he ever saw with his eyes was the slaughter of his sons and of his noblemen. That was the last thing, the last memory of what he saw. And that was the intent, and yet didn't have to happen if he'd have gone peacefully, but he refused to do so, and so as a result he ended up suffering some terrible things as a result of not doing what Jehovah had told him to do, and that was the potential. Could have avoided it all, but the actual was he. Resisted. He stayed in Jerusalem, resisted the king of Babylon, and as a result, he ends up blinded for the rest of his days as he is carried off to Jerusalem. So you see, the difference is quite plain. He could have gone peacefully, could have gone healthy, could have gone with two eyes that could see. Instead, he goes blinded and loses his sons and nobles on top of all of that. And the city is going to be destroyed as well. Now the next part goes on in Jeremiah 39 and also in 2 Kings 25, dealing with the utter destruction of the city and the carrying away of the people off to captivity. And verses 8 through 10, we pick that up in Jeremiah. And it tells you that the Chaldeans burned the king's house and the houses of the people with fire, and break down the walls of Jerusalem. And so there's the destruction of the city as it's torn down. Now we do want to go back to 2 Kings because we do have a little more information there as to the destruction of the city in 2 Kings 25, verses 9 and 10. And we'll pick up in verse 8. And in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which is the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, servant of the king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem. Now he was responsible then. He burnt the house, but notice, he burnt the house of Jehovah. And so he burnt the temple and the king's house and all the houses of Jerusalem. And every great man's house burned he with fire. And so they burned the city, but they burned the wood and what would burn in the temple. They burned it with fire. And so they burned the whole city as we see it here. And then it goes on to describe, and all the army of the Chaldees that were with the captain of the guard break down the walls of Jerusalem round about. And so that's just what we see. They tore the city apart. They broke the walls down. Now those walls that sustained them and protected them for a year and a half to 2.5 years under this siege, but now they are torn down, and then we'll move on to the captivity of the people. So let's go back to Jeremiah 39 for a moment. We'll come back here to 2 Kings 25 in a moment. When we come back to this, verse 10 says, "But Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left the poor of the people which had, I need to start with verse 9, drop down too far. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive into Babylon the remnant of the people that remained in the city, and those that fell away that fell to him with the rest of the people that remained. And so those in the city, those who were outside, all of those in Judah, he hauled them off except for the one group that were described in verse 10. And we'll come back to that. But back in 2 Kings again, you have the reference to, in verse 11, it says, now the rest of the people that were left in the city and the fugitives, those who had fallen away, you have cognate forms of those who had fallen away that fell away to the king of Babylon with the remnant of the multitude, did Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carry away. And so he carries all of those who were anybody left, anybody who owned property, anybody who had any capability of much of anything, he carried those away. Verse 12 goes on, but the captain of the guard left the poor of the land to be vine dressers and husbandmen. Now we'll go back over to Jeremiah for a moment, and we'll see that the reference to leaving the poor. But Nebuzaradan, in verse 10, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left the poor of the people which had nothing. So you see that those who were destitute, absolutely destitute, he left them in the land of Judah and gave them vineyards and fields in that day, it says, at the same time. But in that day, he gave them vineyards and fields. So now, this was a smart move because he left those there it was no good if nobody lived in the land. And so he left the poor, the destitute there to now take care of the vineyards and the fields and the crops so that they could tax them. So they'd get something out of them in the end anyway. And so it wasn't all a total, wouldn't be a loss. They could still get tribute from all of these poor folk who had now resettle in the land. But the rest of the people, anybody who owned anything, anybody who was of any capability of doing anything, they carried them off into Babylon. And so now you have the majority of the people taken away from the land. And again, they'd polluted the land, so they've been removed. Now that reminds me of some of the curses back in Deuteronomy. That if they did some things, that they would be removed from the land. And if we just, we won't spend much time in Deuteronomy, but if you go back to chapter 27, you do have a list of curses upon them. And we will look at some in 27. You have a whole list of different things individually if they do things, plus some blessings. Deuteronomy 28, you have some curses that would overtake them. And things that would take place. Ultimately, their land would not produce, but also in verse in 28:25, it says that they would be destroyed from the land, but it says they would be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth. Well, that's ultimately what happens to them as they're going to be carried off into captivity. But the curses, they were, the choice whether they received the blessings or the curses all depended upon them. And in chapter 30, you have that at the beginning. And it shall come to pass when all these things are come upon thee, the blessings and the curses, which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind, to your heart, among all the nations, whither the Jehovah thy Elohim hath driven thee. And he speaks of how they will be returned. Well, that will be fulfilled one day. But in verse 19, he says, bears them to record this day. He says, I have set before you a life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live. And so at that time they had that potential to be obedient and to live. Well, we come back by the over the centuries with the kings. So you had many wicked kings, many who did evil on the side of Jehovah, and a few who did good, but many of them were bad kings. And we come down to the end of the line now, and Zedekiah is the end of the line as Judah is removed out of the land of promise. And so they've been removed, and now we're going to see that the wealth, everything is going to be stripped out of the city. Let's go back to 2 Kings then, and chapter 25. And we'll pick up where we left off there with the, you have the burning of the temple. But in verse 13, it describes how all of the wealth that was left behind at the temple was carried away into Babylon. And so he strips the wealth that's remaining there in 13 through 17. And the pillars of brass that were in the house of Jehovah, and the bases and the brazen sea that was in the house of Jehovah, did the Chaldees break in pieces and carried the brass of them to Babylon. And the pots and the shovels and the snuffers and the spoons and all the vessels of brass wherewith they ministered took they away. And the fire pans and the bowls and such things as were of gold, in gold and of silver, and silver and the in gold and silver, the captain of the guard took away. Now you come to these two pillars, the one sea and the bases which Solomon had made for the house of Jehovah. The brass of all these vessels was without weight, and so it was very heavy, with all very valuable, and so they carried it all away to Babylon. Now he describes the height of one of these pillars. He says the height of the one pillar was 18 cubits. Now if you figure that out, and it depends on who was king and what they considered a cubit, we'll go with 18 inches, say it was about 18 inches. That makes it about a 37-foot tall pillar. So that's a pretty good pillar. And so that was that big. The chapiter upon it was brass. And the height of the chapiter, 3 cubits. And so that would make it, about 4.5 feet tall. And so you've got over 41 feet in height there of just this, the pillar with the top and the wreathen work and the pomegranates upon the chapiter round about all of the brass. And like unto these had the second pillar with wreathen work. So anyway, there was a lot of valuable metals in all of these things in the temple. Well, they broke it up, and this was what was left from before, and they carried it all off to Babylon. And so they've stripped the city pretty much of its wealth. And they've not only that, they've burned the temple, they've burned the king's house, they burned the houses in Jerusalem, and so they've leveled Jerusalem. And it sounds to me like it's we look at pictures of some of the World War II cities that were demolished. You had nothing but rubble, just like that. If you look at some of the pictures in Japan after the atomic blast, they were just leveled. You had the fires of Dresden. They probably had more walls standing in Dresden than they did in Jerusalem. But they absolutely tore the city down, just as God had said this would happen because of their failure to be obedient, to keep the law, and because of their idolatry that they continued to do. Now, moving on, we're in 2 Kings still. 2 Kings describes this in detail, whereas Jeremiah doesn't come to the priests and the keepers of the door. But in 2 Kings 25:18 through 21, we come to a description of their demise. And the captain of the guard took Seraiah, the chief priest, and Zephaniah, the second priest, and the three keepers at the door, or the threshold. And so he takes these, the chief priests and such, and out of the city he took an officer. The word officer describes a eunuch, probably, that was set over the men of war, and five men of them that were in the king's presence. They were in his face, which were found in the city. And the principal scribe of the host, the scribe of the captain of the host of their army, which mustered the people of the land, and 80 men of the people of the land that were found in the city. And Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, took these and brought them to the king of Babylon, to Riblah. And so they take them just as they had done with Zedekiah. Now Zedekiah, he survived, blinded, but he survived, lost his offspring, lost his noblemen, he lost all of those. But now notice what happens to these religious leaders and these others. And the king of Babylon smote them and slew them at Riblah in the land of Hamath, so Judah was carried away out of their land. And so this is the result. This is the prophecy that had been Jeremiah had been telling them was going to take place. This is the utter removal of Judah out of the land. And so there were a few poor people who were left to populate the land and to take care of it. But they're going to be intermarrying and everything else as well. As time goes on, when they come back to rebuild the walls of the city in Nehemiah and Ezra and Nehemiah's day and the rebuilding of the temple. But you're going to have the majority of the people are gone. The land has been stripped. And so Judah is, as it says here, they were carried away out of their land. So they're out of the land of Judah. And so God did remove them, just as he said that he would. And the potential could have been different, though. And so that is something. Within the decree, God does have the actual and potential. He knows what the actual is going to be. He also knows what the potential could be. And sometimes he'll express what the potential just might be. But he does give man a choice. He doesn't make them make the choices they do, but men do make the choices that they're responsible totally for their choices. And so that's the account that we see back here in 2 Kings 25. And he goes on a little further. We'll come back here for one more reference a little bit later on. But we'll go back to Jeremiah 39 now. And as we come to Jeremiah 39, we are going to pick up with some instruction from the king concerning the prophet Jeremiah. And so this instruction, you have the charge given by Nebuchadnezzar in verses 11 and 12. And so in verse 11, you have the instruction concerning Jeremiah. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, we'll just read it, Nebuchadnezzar, it reads Drezer, but anyway, same guy, king of Babylon, gave charge concerning Jeremiah by the hand of Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, saying. Now, it's kind of interesting, Jeremiah, he's been a thorn in the ruler's in the sight of the rulers of Judah, from the square one, because he has told them prophecy from Jehovah what was going to happen to them. And so as he speaks to them of these things, doesn't set very well. He's suffered a great deal because of his message. And how in the world Nebuchadnezzar down in Babylon hears of Jeremiah, we don't know. But we do know that Jeremiah did write to those who were in Babylon. And back in chapter 26, he does a lot of that. He writes concerning those who were down in Babylon. And so he wrote to them some prophecies of what would take place. And you had descriptions of how the king of Babylon is going to be punished. I don't know if that made it to him back in 2512, but you do have a reference he wrote back there. Also, we had a previous captivity, and so there were some of the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, the southern kingdom Judah, some were already down in Babylon, and maybe those got the information from, maybe they talked of Jeremiah, but somehow he knew about Jeremiah. And so God is going to intervene for Jeremiah again. Now, it looks, to put it together, it looks as if they were kind of let off, but he is in the prison. He's in the court of the guard, where he is a prisoner when Jerusalem fell. Now, it's likely that he was maybe shipped off with others, but he's sent back to to be under the guard. But he is going to be spared. God still has more work for Jeremiah the prophet to do. And so we'll notice that as we get into the next verses here. But he gave charge, saying in verse 12, take him, this is Jeremiah, take him and look well to him. Set your eyes upon him. You look upon him. And do him no harm, but do unto him even as he shall say unto thee. And so he's going to treat him, he treats him well. Nebuchadnezzar Adon is not to do anything that would hurt Jeremiah. The Jews have done that enough by his own people. But Nebuchadnezzar steps in, and God uses Nebuchadnezzar to spare Jeremiah. But do as he says unto you. And so he has the instruction, the captain of the guard, Nebuchadnezzar Adon, he is to do to Jeremiah as whatever Jeremiah says, and that's at the king of Babylon's instruction to him. Now, this is going to take place, and so that's just what Nebuchadnezzar Adon does, verses 13 and 14. So Nebuchadnezzar Adon, the captain of the guard, sent, and Nebushashban, Rabsaras, and Nergal-Sharezer, Ragma, and all the king of Babylon's princes. And so he sends these leaders down, and when even they sent and took Jeremiah out of the court of the prison. And so now he is removed from the court of the guard where he's imprisoned. And notice it says, and committed unto him, they gave him unto Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, that he should carry him home. So he dwelt among the people. Now, it's kind of interesting when we look at this Gedaliah, and we have his father and his grandfather's names here. We've seen his grandfather's name, but his grandfather, if we've traced him back, we won't take the time to track him down through Scripture. But if we did, we would see that Shaphan was the one who found the law, the scrolls of the law, in the temple during the days of Josiah, when Josiah was a young king, very young child as king. But the law had been lost, and they had forgotten the law, and they had lost the law. But now he comes with the law. He finds the law. Ahikam took the law. His son took the law, took it over to hold of the prophetess to confirm that this was the law of Jehovah. And she did. And so they found the law, and then they again began to read the law in Josiah's day. And so they got to the place, they were so far away from Jehovah that they'd even forgotten and lost his law. But now Shaphan found it, and Ahikam has it confirmed. And this is, Gedaliah is the son of Ahikam and the grandson of Shaphan, as we find these men here. Interestingly enough, Shaphan had another son who had another grandson by another son, and his name was Micaiah. And so he's the one who told them the reading of Jeremiah's prophecy as it had been read. And so it comes from a family, and so there were a few families in Judah who did stand for the law and seem to have that, and we will see some of that as we look at this fellow Gedaliah. In fact, let's go ahead and go back to 2 Kings again and 25, and we'll notice Gedaliah back here, and verse 24, "And Gedaliah sware to them and to their men, and said unto them, Fear not to be the servants of the Chaldees, dwell in the land, and serve the king of Babylon, and it shall be well with you." And so he instructs these various men to do what they ought to do, and if they just do what the king of Babylon says, they'll survive. And he's not said to be a prophet here, but he does, as a leader, he does tell them what they need to do. Then we come over to verse 25, and they murder him ultimately. "But it came to pass in the seventh month that Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, the son of Elishama, of the seed royal, came, and 10 men with him, and smote Gedaliah, that he died, and the Jews and the Chaldeans that were with him at Mizpah." And so you had this rebellion here where they killed this man. Well, back over in Jeremiah chapter 40, in chapter 40 we do have a reference to Gedaliah again in verse 7. "Now when all the captains of the forces which were in the fields, even they and their men, heard that the king of Babylon had made Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, governor in the land." So he's the governor of the land, made governor of the land by Nebuchadnezzar, and had, when it says he had appointed unto him men and women and children, and of the poor of the land, of them that were not carried away captive to Babylon. And it goes on to describe Gedaliah's, what we saw in 2 Kings 25, verse 9, he gives his word, "Fear not to serve the Chaldeans," and so forth. And then it goes on to describe Gedaliah further there. But we're back to Jeremiah, though, being released into the custody of Gedaliah, and in the protection of Gedaliah, the governor who's to become the governor of the land after Zedekiah the king is removed. And so he goes to the home, though. He should carry him home, it says in verse 14. "So he dwelt among the people." So Jeremiah is there. He stays in the land with all of the poor people who are now taking care of the land. And that's where, and so Jeremiah is cared for. Now we don't have it in exact chronological order again. Now Jeremiah jumps back to some words that were spoken to him while he was still shut up in the court of the prison or the guard, and he's to go to Evil-Melech, the Ethiopian who rescued him from the cistern of mud, where he was sinking in the mud at the bottom of this pit. He's to go and speak to this fellow. And so as you come to verse 16, we do see the appearance. We have, first of all, you have another reference to an appearance of the pre-incarnate Son of God in verse 15. "Now the word of Jehovah was unto Jeremiah while he was shut up in the court of the prison, saying," or the court of the guard, "saying." And so that's our setting here for what is done here. He's still in the court under guard. And so it goes on and describes what he's supposed to do. And so it says, "Go and speak to Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, saying, Thus saith Jehovah Sabaoth, the one who's over the heavenly armies, the Elohim of Israel, Behold, I will bring my words upon this city for evil and not for good, and they shall be accomplished in that day before thee. And so he tells him, this is, and so the time frame here is before Nebuchadnezzar and his forces break through into the city and before the city is destroyed. But he says that his the words Jehovah has spoken, they're going to be, it's going to be a calamity for those who are, for the city and those within the city because of what they have done. And he continues, but I will deliver thee. And so notice the thee goes back to Ebed-Melech. He says, I will deliver thee in that day, saith Jehovah. And thou shalt not be given into the hand of men of whom, of the men of whom you are afraid. And I will surely deliver thee, and thou shalt not fall by the sword. And so he's going to be spared. His life will be spared. Now back over in 38:2, if Zedekiah didn't leave the city in peace, he says, he that remaineth in this city shall die by the sword. But I said, you won't, to Ebed-Melech, by famine and by pestilence. And so he was guaranteed the preservation of his life. And he explains it in verse 18, for I will surely deliver thee, delivering, he's going to be delivered, and thou shalt not fall by the sword, but thy life shall be a prey unto thee, because thou hast put trust in me, saith Jehovah. And so we find an indicator here that this Ethiopian, he did have trust in Jehovah, and I would believe that he would be counted as one who would be an Old Testament saint in this place, and God spared his life because he did trust in Jehovah. We don't know anything further outside of that he rescued Jeremiah and that he trusted in Jehovah here, and Jehovah is going to spare his life at the hand of the Chaldeans as they've come in and conquered the city, or as it will be conquered. And so God did spare him because of that. But Jeremiah, he's been preserved, and that's where we find him in chapter 39. And so you have the city utterly destroyed, and now you have, he's going to carry on with prophecy. Now, as we noted back in 2 Kings 25, all Judah was carried away out of the land, and so they were gone. And yet, when we go back to Deuteronomy, we see that God does promise he's going to bring them back into the land in the future. But if they are disobedient, they will suffer. And that's just what happened. God was true to his word. The prophecies of Jeremiah and his dealing with the kings of Judah, the mostly evil kings in Judah, when he dealt with these kings, ultimately God did bring his judgment upon the city, upon the people, and upon the southern kingdom. And so they're gone out of the land. And at that point, then, the northern kingdom Israel is in captivity. The southern kingdom Judah is in captivity. The land is going to have its rest. They're removed. And so they're under judgment. And yet we do know that one day they will be brought back into the land. Not just a few, but all of Israel will be brought back into the land in the future. And God has his promises to them that they will come back and they will be saved. All Israel will be saved, but that's to go into the millennial kingdom after he has cleaned their ranks out of those who are rebels, and there will only be believing Jews left from the tribulation to go into the kingdom. But this is where we see the nation removed from the land. Now, they will have some coming back in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. You have those accounts. We also have them living there in the days when the Lord was there. But in 586 B.C., that you had the fall there. In 70 A.D., Herod's temple was destroyed, and that was yet future. And there again, those who had come back into the land, the whole land, they're gone. But they will be brought back into the land. And so God, we can see one thing we can see is that God is faithful. And when he makes a prophecy, we take it literally, and we see that God will fulfill it just as he said, literally. And so that's where we'll stop today. Father, we're thankful again for your word as we've looked into it. We're thankful even as we look at these things that we do see your faithfulness, your dependableness, that we can depend upon you, and that you are faithful to your word. And even though we don't come here to find out what we do to live, yet we do see that it is well to do your will and to be in the center of your will, to do that which is pleasing to you. Life does go better for us if we are in your will. And yet we're thankful as we look at this that we see that we can depend upon you and your word, that you will fulfill all prophecies that are not fulfilled. And particular with us, we're thankful as we have the prospects of the imminent return of your son to catch us away, that will be fulfilled, just as Jerusalem was taken and fell, and just as they will be brought back in the future, you do have something better for us in between, and so we're thankful for that now. Amen.